All right, y'all. Let me pray for us, and then we'll get going here. Father, thank you for all the ways you provide for us and bless us. And we thank you for just allowing us to get together today after all the snow and sleet and ice and all the mess going on. Pray this week all that'll continue to thaw out quickly and get things back to normal. Pray for those who aren't able to get out of the house. I've talked to several people that are down, just dealing with the depression of being not able to get out. So pray for them. Lift them, put them before you. Pray for our time here. You'll give us wisdom and insight into your word and help us to understand these things that you've freely given to us so that we can have hope. And we ask all this for Jesus' great name's sake. Amen. All right, y'all, today we're in chapter 2 of 2 Samuel. We got there week before last. I'm going to do a little bit of review. In your notes, page 45 is the beginning of 2 Samuel. Of course, we've had the death of Saul at the very end of 1 Samuel. He is killed in battle along with Jonathan, two of the main characters, of course, leading up to where we are now. 2 Samuel chapter 1, we had a messenger come to David to tell him that Saul had been killed. The man was an Amalekite, and he had claimed that he was the one that had killed Saul, and David put him to death, if you remember that. And then at the end of chapter 1, David gives a poem in Hebrew poetry over the death of Saul and Jonathan, his great friend. And so chapter 1 of 2 Samuel really is a hinge chapter that takes us from 1 Samuel into the narrative that's going to be 2 Samuel. It's also a great dividing point because this is technically where David is going to become king, going to be recognized as king over Israel. Now, if you remember, Samuel has already anointed him to be the next king to replace Saul, but that has not been officially recognized by the kingdom yet, by the whole nation of Israel. And so that's where we're going to pick up today, very bottom of page 45. David is made king over Israel. And again, we're going to be reading bits and pieces of verses going through. So chapter two, verse one, let's read just a little bit of this, and then we'll make a few comments on some things. Again, in these chapters, there's not a lot that's difficult to understand, but boy, a lot happens very quickly. If y'all have read this in these first several chapters here. So chapter 2, verse 1, it says, after this, that is, after getting the news about Saul and Jonathan being killed, David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah?" And the Lord said to him, "Go up." David said, "To which shall I go up?" And he said, "To Hebron." So David went up there, and his two wives also, Ahinoam of Jezreel, Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And David brought up his men who were with him, everyone with his household, and they lived in the towns of Hebron. And the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. Look at verse 4 specifically, right? Notice Judah is mentioned. And this is really interesting because already at this time, there is a division, a seeming division between the northern tribes of Israel and Judah. And so already you have some of that separation going on. And at this point, it is only Judah that's recognized David as king. And we're going to see him being recognized as king kind of in a couple of different stages as we're going forward. But here he is recognized in his land. Remember, this is where David's from. He's from the southern territories, Bethlehem. And so his clans are recognizing him as king. Several things about that. Bottom of page 45, there's a fairly lengthy note down at the very bottom under David is made king over Judah. This section that we're in is the high point, the turning point for David. And what we mean by these first several chapters through chapter 7, 8. In fact, chapter 7 is where we get recounted the covenant, the promises that the Lord makes to David. And 2 Samuel 7 is, in my mind, one of the most important chapters in the whole Old Testament. One of the, I don't know, seven or eight most important chapters in the Old Testament. And then after that, everything just kind of goes downhill, right? You know, if y'all know the story, things start to degenerate, spiral out of control because of David's sin and some other things that happened there. But several things happen here in this section that had been either prophesied earlier or had been set in motion earlier. Number one, the rise of the tribe of Judah over Israel. That's in fulfillment of the prophecy that Jacob made in Genesis 49:10, if you remember that. On his deathbed, he's going around and he's making blessings and also foretelling the future for his 12 sons. And in that, he makes the point that Judah is going to be elevated and that the king's scepter will not depart from Judah until he comes to whom it is due, which y'all know that looks to Jesus, right? All the way back in Genesis 49. So Judah is going to rise in power over Israel. Secondly, we may get to this today, I'm not sure. We get the capture of Jerusalem, where the Lord put his name for his dwelling. That had been foreseen earlier. The Lord had hinted at that. And so David's going to go in and he's going to take Jerusalem. And from this point forward, it's going to be the capital of Israel. I was talking about that in another class, and somebody said, wait a minute, it's not till David that they got Jerusalem, you know? And that's one of those things that, you know, we're just so used to thinking about Jerusalem being the capital city. You think, well, that goes way back. And it does, in a sense. It does go way back. It just wasn't called Jerusalem. But here, David takes it, and it's going to be both the political and the religious center for Israel from that point forward. You also get the acquisition of territories promised to Abraham that were never fully taken over. David is going to fulfill part of that. And you also get stories of the destruction of Moab, Edom, and Amalek, which the Lord also had foretold. David is instrumental in each of those being destroyed, which is interesting because both Moab and Edom, those prophecies are not about their complete destruction. And we'll talk about that a little bit later when we get to those. So we have a lot of things coming together in fulfillment prophetically in these early chapters in 2 Samuel. And of course, it all hinges around David becoming the king. Top of page 46. Well, first of all, any questions or comments on any of that? Yeah, happy. I'll get having you come up today. He was recognized by basically all of Israel. Yeah, sure was. A great, great question.
That's God's yeah. It was
basically clan squabbles, you know, during the time of Joshua and the conquest. Like you have the, we talked about this earlier, you have the Benjaminites, yeah, that all the sins that they did, you know, yeah, got them out of sorts with the other tribes. So it's just family infighting, you know, everything going on. One of the things that I find so fascinating is if you go all the way back to Abraham, right, and you have, first of all, you get the early family issue with him having Ishmael, right, through
Hagar.
Thank you, Mama. I hadn't got my mind jump started yet. Hagar, right? So you get that. That leads to controversy on down the way. But then if you look at the nations that come from Abraham with his second wife, right? Most of those people become the Babylonians and the Assyrians and, you know, all the other people that are going to go on. Of course, Moab and Edom, that's close family relations, if you remember all that. So one of the things that I find so interesting is that everything that happens in the Old Testament is just a big old family squabble. You know, it's just a big old soap opera that takes place in the descendants of Abraham through that. Which, you know, it shouldn't surprise us. That's the way all our families work, right? Nothing's changed, yeah? I was talking to a friend of mine years ago. He said, you know, one of the great mysteries of life is how in the world can it be in the same family you have the people that you love the most and hate the most all at the same time? I said, bro, I don't know. You're right. That is a great mystery. Great questions. Anybody else questions on any of that? All right. Top page 46. We just read this. David is anointed in Hebron. Hebron is going to be central over the next couple of chapters here. And a couple of interesting things about it. Number one, it was the largest city of refuge in Judah. And this was a place, if you remember, a city of refuge is where somebody who was falsely accused of murder could flee and find sanctuary there. Hebron was also set apart for the priesthood. So the fact that the Lord tells David to go to Hebron sets up some significant things that are about to happen in these next several chapters. Judah, the second thing there, top of page 46, David's recognized king here, but yet not yet all Israel is going to recognize him as king. So things are starting off well, but we still have a couple of pieces of the puzzle to add to it. Back in your text, the next thing, and also in your notes, page 46.422, David honors the people of Jabesh Gilead who buried Saul. I'm not going to read all of that. That's in chapter 2, just 3 verses, 4 through 7. David hears that men of Jabesh Gilead had gone to get Saul and Jonathan's body. You remember that? The Philistines had taken their bodies and desecrated them. And so those David honors those people for risking their lives to go and get Saul's body and bring him back. So which is interesting. One of the things that we're going to see in these next several chapters, and I don't want to spoil too much of it yet, is how David always gives honor to those who are left from the house of Saul. He doesn't take vengeance against that house. And part of that comes from, I think, if you remember, we only spent just a few minutes on this. If you remember in the stories where David spares Saul the first time, where Saul goes in the cave and David spares him. And then in between that, you get the story of Abigail and Nabal. And David is going to go down and kill Nabal, right? And Abigail intervenes and says, no, you can't do that and bring that blood guilt on your head. And part of that was because David did not have the right to go take vengeance on Nabal. He was supposed, according to Torah instruction, he was supposed to leave vengeance to the Lord for how Nabal had offended him. And so Abigail intervenes and says, no, you can't do that. You, and I love this, she says to him, you cannot work salvation. You cannot work deliverance with your own hand. It's not in your right to do that. And later when David is responding to her, he says, you're so right. I'm so glad you came down and intervened because it's not in my right to work salvation, deliverance by my own hand. And if I had put this blood guilt on me, it would have followed me from here on out. So very important chapter. I don't know if I said this in class because I'm probably afraid of getting in trouble. But Abigail is she has the longest recorded speech from a woman in the Old Testament. And part of that is because she's functioning as a prophet to David, right? She is sent by God to give the king a message that keeps him from doing evil. That's the very role of a prophet. And she does it in the context of setting it in light of future events. Didn't the Lord set you apart as the next king? And she even says to him something that David himself doesn't even believe. And that is, wait a minute, if the Lord has set you apart as the next king, then it doesn't matter who's chasing after you to try to kill you. They're not going to be successful because you're the next king. And it's not until Abigail says that to David that I think the light comes on for him. Oh, yeah, you're right. Saul's not going to be able to kill me, right? Even though just the chapter before, David had fled because he was sure that Saul was going to eventually kill him. Right? So very important chapter.
Doesn't she kind of appeal to
him?
As opposed to...
Yeah, right, yeah.
She appeals.
Yeah, yeah. which is always what a good prophet does, right?
He responded.
Yeah. And think about what's going to happen, right? A little bit later, you have Nathan the prophet.
And what is he? Story.
Yeah, tells him the story. Hey, there was a man who had some sheep, right? Really, really powerful. But one of the main things that comes out of that story is David realizes it's not in his power to seek retributive justice, vengeful, quote unquote, justice. And so when we come into 2 Samuel, he doesn't take revenge against the house of Saul. And this is really important. It shows that he's not going to be a king like the other nations have, right? That's what Israel wanted. Give us a king that we might be like all the other nations. David is a very different king, because in the kings of the pagan nations, when they would come to power, the first thing you would do is kill anybody in the former king's family that might try to claim the throne. David avoids that at every turn. Part of that is because I think what he learns in the Abigail episode, that it's not up to him, it's not for him to work salvation by his own hand. Wait on the Lord. He's going to take care of this. He's going to take care of things. So really, man, the way these stories are interwoven, just masterful. You know, incredible. Yeah, John?
How old is David now? Because doesn't he have children that are grown?
Yes, we're about to read that.
From the time he was anointed to now.
Yeah.
How many years have passed?
It's been, if I remember right, I am, one of the things I'm working on, y'all, that I haven't got together yet, is a chronology of all of this, you know, like a actual, because we are jumping forwards and backwards in this. I think if I remember right, this is 20 something years after he was anointed by Samuel. Critical words.
At least 20 years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, David has already had some, in fact, we're about to read, let's see, where is it that it, it's in these chapters we're about to read about his sons. Where are they? And it's just in a little offhand thing. And I've even got a note about it, but I... in chapter 5, verses 13 through 14. Which this is a problematic passage. David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem after he came from Hebron. More sons and daughters were born to David. These were the names of those who were born in Jerusalem. And it lists off some of his sons there. His daughters, as far as I can tell, are not mentioned. So he's been having kids throughout this. They're just not all named until we get these summarized passages. So quite a number of years are passed. Also, if you look what we're about to read here, back in chapter 2, verse 11, and we're about to read this, but in chapter 2, verse 11, it says, "Now the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years, 6 months." So from the time that Judah recognizes him as king in Hebron to the time he comes in and takes Jerusalem and does those things, that's 7 years. So, yeah, we're dealing with stretches of time where he ostensibly is having kids. And, you know, in the Old Testament, in the ancient Near East, you get a wife and you're immediately having kids, right? They're not waiting until they get a college degree or, you know, so all throughout this, more than likely David's family's growing. And that's, of course, that's going to cause some problems a little bit later, as y'all know. Anybody else? Any questions or comments on any of that? All right, chapter 2. Let's read verse 8. Let's pick up in verse 8 so we can see what's going on here, because this is going to set us up for some intrigue. Chapter 2, 2 Samuel chapter 2, verse 8. It says, "Now Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, took Ish-bosheth." Boy, that's a hard... Ish-bosheth, that's a hard name to say. "Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. And he made him king over Gilead and the Asherites and Jezreel and Ephraim and Benjamin and all of Israel." So David's been recognized in Judah, but now Abner's trying to make Ish-bosheth king over everybody else. Now, verse 10, Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel, and he reigned 2 years. But the house of Judah followed David. So there again, you can see the split. Abner tries to make Ishbosheth king over the rest of the territories, but Judah is following David. So here comes Abner. Now, there's something about Abner I want you to remember. And I don't have a note necessarily about this, but on page 46, if you remember back in 1 Samuel 26, that was the second time that David spared Saul's life. And that was the time when Saul and his troops were trying to pursue David. And they had camped and they had fallen asleep, and the Lord put a deep sleep on them. And David went down into the camp and stole the spear and the water jug that was at Saul's head, and then came back out. You remember that episode. So he spared Saul's life the second time. But in that time, when David called out to him, he didn't call out to Saul. He called out to Abner. He said, "Hey, Abner, what are y'all doing? Wake up." And basically, David shames him publicly. "What kind of operation are y'all running? Aren't you supposed to be guard of the king? If you were really guarding over the Lord's anointed, why would I have his spear in the water jug?" Right? So he publicly shames Abner for not doing his job, which is a big deal in the Old Testament. So guess who it is that gets one of Saul's sons? And that says, no. We're not going to recognize David. We're going to do our own thing. Right? It's Abner. And I have a sneaking suspicion that it's because of the way David had shamed him earlier. That may not be a sufficient cause, right? But it's at least, I think, a necessary cause for Abner doing what he does here. And so he takes Ishbosheth and tries to make him king. Something really interesting, there's a fairly lengthy note about this on page 46. And this is one of the places where in the scriptures, oftentimes you'll have people that go by several different names. You've probably noticed that before. And sometimes they're updating names because it's using some older form of Hebrew or something going on like that. But here, Ishbosheth, that name in Hebrew literally means man of shame. Right? Now, I don't think his mama gave him that name. Right? Pretty sure. I mean, the way people name their kids nowadays, it may not surprise me, but I don't know mama going along with that. The interesting thing, though, is that in First Chronicles, he is referred to as Eshbaal, which means fire of Baal or man of Baal. There are many Hebrew names that originally had this title Baal in it, Baal, you know, in the south. Now, immediately when we hear that, what do we think of? Baal, the god, right? The god of the thunderstorm and all the rest. He has another name, Had, in your note down there about almost halfway down over to the left. That's the thing we think of. But in Hebrew and in those other related languages, that word just means Lord. Right? Baal, it just means Lord. So Baal, Lord of the thunderclouds, right? And that was a title that the early Hebrews actually used for the Lord. He was the Lord of this, Lord of that. But once Ahab brought the worship of this Canaanite god that they just simply, you know, referred to with that title, Baal, the Lord said, "Don't call me by that name anymore, because now it's been usurped," and whatever. So many of those old Hebrew names that had Baal in it, which just meant Lord, they replaced the Baal with something else. And in this case, and in many cases, they replaced it with this Bosheth, which means shame. Jonathan has a son that we're going to run into here, one of the most glorious stories in 2 Samuel, if you remember it, named Ishbosheth. Remember that? I'm not Ishbosheth. Mephibosheth, right? Mephibosheth, right? Well, his name was probably originally Mephibaal or Mary Baal back at the time of David and Saul. But it becomes changed later to that name because they didn't want to keep this reference to one of the Canaanite gods later. So really, really interesting. It didn't. So in other words, at the time of David, this word Baal would have just meant Lord. But after the time of Ahab, it becomes associated with the Canaanite god. And so it's those names are redone. They're recast. So here, Ish-bosheth comes on the scene. He's one of Saul's sons, and Abner tries to take him and make him king over Israel, over the remaining tribes and so forth. On page 46, down a little bit, under that long note about Ish-bosheth, you have the reign of Ish-bosheth. There, gosh, that is so hard to say. I'm just going to start calling him IB. You know, something about him is that in the 2 years of his reign, he's only mentioned doing three things. One, wrongly accusing Abner of misconduct. Two, giving his sister Michal back to David. And lying on his bed. In short, he's presented as a weak and incompetent ruler, right? I wonder where he learned that from. So here, Abner tries to make him king, but Judah sides with David. Now, in the rest of chapter 2, you get this in and out soap opera. Well, it's not even soap opera. This is just a good vengeance tale. This is a good fight, kick and scratch like a big white dog type kind of situation here. Chapter 2, verse 12. So Abner, along with the servants of Ish-bosheth, they go out and they're going to go against Joab, who is leading David's forces. And so they meet by this pool, and they come up with this idea. Let's not all get into the battle hill here. Let's take your 12 men. And 12 of our men, and we'll have them come down and we'll do ritual combat. Remember, this is what David and Goliath did. Instead of the whole army going to battle, we'll pick our representatives, and whoever comes out on top, that's who wins the battle. So we don't have to have just endless bloodshed here today. So they pick 12 from each side. They come forward, and lo and behold, they all kill each other equally, right? They strike each other at the same time and both fall down. It's said there in verse 16 that place is called Helkath Hazarim in Gibeon. That is the field of the sword edges because of that battle that took place. So that doesn't work out. And then they break into battle, right? The whole thing breaks into battle. And you have the three sons, verse 18, it says you got three sons of Zeruiah. Well, that's a great name, isn't it? Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. And Asahel was swift on foot as a wild gazelle. And so Asahel breaks off and he goes after Abner to try to take him out because Abner's the leader, right? If you take out the general, then usually all the other forces will just kind of cave in. So Asahel runs after him. And Abner looks back and realizes, oh, Lord, it's Asahel. He says, Asahel, is it you? And he says, yeah, it's me. I'm after you. So Abner knows, oh, Lord, this boy's going to catch me, right? So Abner tries to reason with him. Listen, turn aside to your right or your left. Just give up. Don't keep on coming after me. But Asahel will not. He will not relent. Says, no, I'm coming to get you. He refuses to turn aside. And so Abner takes his spear and he runs the blunt end backwards as Asahel gets up on him and runs him completely through with the spear. Runs in the front and comes out the back. That's pretty serious. I mean, you know, I read a study that was done years ago that talked about ancient warfare, Middle Ages, and even at this time. And they were talking about the weapons that were used. And the thing that always stuck out to me was recurved bows that were used in the Middle Ages. The amount of force that you had to have to pull one back was about 250 pounds. Now, to put that in effect, that's pulling 250 pounds back like this. They were saying there's no modern human that has the strength to do that way, you know. And they were just talking about in these ancient battles, you know, humans were a lot stronger than we are now. And this is one of those stories that emphasizes it. Yeah, you know, you're walking around all day long and fighting and carrying on. So Joab, Abner runs Asahel through with the spear and kills him there as he's following after him. Joab and Abishai, his two brothers, they then turn and they go after Abner to try to pursue him, and they follow him all day, run after him all day until he finally gets back quite a ways away from the original battle. And Abner calls out to him and basically says to him, y'all listen, give this up. If we don't stop the fight now, there's going to be nobody left in all of this, right? And so part of what we see here is this idea of revenge and vengeance killing. Once that kind of thing starts, it never stops, right? Unless you have somebody that puts an end to it. David is going to try to put an end to it, but it's not going to stick. The McCoys and the Hatfields. Yeah, McCoy. Yeah. One death is done and all the rest. And again, David is going to break that. He's going to try to break that cycle with this. Abner tries to convince him to break the cycle, and he does. Joab and his men, they give up and realize, yep, Abner's probably right. We're going to call a stop to this. But it's not going to stick, and we'll see that here in just a second. Top of page 47 in your notes there. Let's see. Yeah, I've already talked about the things on bottom page 46. Top of page 47, just some things for context. Zeruiah that we just mentioned, that's David's sister. And so Joab, Abishai, and Asahel are all his nephews. Right? That's not something that you immediately pick up on. So again, you know, these are people out of David's own family. And again, you know, Abner, after he kills Asahel, they are running after him, and he pleads with them in 226, right? If we continue, when will the killing stop? And he's right in that, right? If they keep on trying to do the same thing over and over again, it's never going to stop. But the really interesting thing is that if you look at the numbers that are mentioned in this chapter, Joab's forces dealt a severe blow to Abner's forces. After the initial 12 men were killed, right? Apparently there were only 7 more on the side of David that were lost in battle, whereas they killed 360 of Abner's forces. So, I mean, this is a decisive victory, you know? And so Abner pleading with Joab and them, it's really just to save his own skin, more than likely, right? Like, because he's next on the list. I mean, almost everybody else has been done in. But all that's going to change. All that's going to change in the next chapter through some foolishness that happens. All right, chapter 3. There was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And David grew stronger and stronger while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. Remember, David is ruling in, or he's in Hebron. And so we assume that this has taken place during those 7 years that David was there. Then in chapter 3, verse 2, you get the sons that were born to David in Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon of Ahinoam of Jezreel. The second, right, of Abigail. You can read through the names. Notice there's some more wives that are mentioned there that have not appeared up until this point. And in the middle of page 47, I've got a note there that the list of David's wives, because they're all mentioned in context of where they came from, what territory they're from. By David marrying these wives, he's consolidating his power through marriage from these different territories, right? So again, it's what we're talking about with the clans and the families. He's strengthening his family connections and so forth. And so the list of sons that are mentioned, at least here, would have been most likely the line of succession to the throne, right? Amnon is specifically referred to as the firstborn. And then it goes down the line, Kileab, Absalom, Adonijah, Shephatiah, and Ithream. So that's the line. Now, as y'all know, that's not at all the way it's going to play out, right? That's not going to be the line of succession. But here, they're mentioned to show how David's family is growing. And of course, you know, the people in the ancient Near East, they would read this as a sign of God's blessing, that he's being fruitful and he's multiplying, right? His family is growing while the house of Saul is diminishing. And we'll see those kind of just offhand comments throughout these next several chapters that indicate that the Lord's hand of blessing was on him. Then, verse 6, 2 Samuel chapter 3, verse 6. It says, now, while there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. There's been endless speculation over whether or not Abner picked Ish-bosheth to be the king because he knew this boy is so weak, I'm going to be able to do what I need to do, right? I'm going to be the power behind the figurehead on the throne, right? I think there's probably something to that. But Abner is getting more and more influential in the house of Saul. And then it's verse 7, now Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, why have you gone into my father's concubine? And Abner was very angry over the words of Ishbosheth and said, am I a dog's head of Judah? To this day I keep showing steadfast love to the house of Saul, your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not given you into the hand of David? And yet you charge me today with a fault concerning a woman? God do so to Abner and more also if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him. Stop right there. Look at verse 9. Right? Abner knows without a doubt that the Lord God has sworn to David to make him the next king. So this is willful rebellion on Abner's part, right? But whatever Ishbosheth is charging him with, Abner neither confirms nor denies it, right? He just says, listen, I've been serving you all throughout this thing. Why in the world are you bringing this up against me? So we're never told whether these accusations are correct or not, because if Abner was going into one of Saul's concubines, that would have been a subtle claim to royal power, right? But it seems like that, whatever the case, Abner does not, you know, he does not confirm that that's true. So most likely, it may not be true because of how angry he gets about it. But the big deal is, right, verse 9, he shifts. and he decides, okay, well, that's the way you're going to treat me. I'm going to go to David. So he says, I'm going to go in and help accomplish what the Lord has sworn to David, which is incredible. Verse 10, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan to Beersheba. Now, those are critical words. Notice Abner is saying he's going to help establish the kingdom over all the territories of both Israel and Judah, but also from the territory of Dan to Beersheba, which harkens back to the Abrahamic promises. That was the central land that was promised to Abraham to be the place where his descendants would dwell. Verse 11, and Ishbosheth could not answer Abner another word because he feared him. And so, verse 12, Abner sent messengers to David on his behalf, saying, to whom does the land belong? Make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you to bring over all of Israel to you. Wow. Now, remember, Abner had amassed most of the tribes under Ishbosheth as opposed to David. So if Abner is now on David's side, he should be able to bring all those clans over to David and consolidate the kingdom. Verse 13. And so David said, David responds, good, I will make a covenant with you, but one thing I require of you. That is, you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face. And then David sent messengers to Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, saying, give me my wife Michal, for whom I paid the bridal price of 100 foreskins of the Philistines. Y'all remember all that? Saul had simply taken Michal away from David. There was never a divorce, quote unquote, right? She had simply been taken away. And so David says, I want my first wife back. Verse 15, Ish-bosheth sent and took her from her husband Paltiel, the son of Laish. But her husband went with her, weeping after her all the way to Bahurim. But Abner said to him, go, return. And he returned. Talking about soap opera, right? David gets Michal back, the first wife that he had from Saul's house. This also, in part, is probably meant to show his right over Saul's house, right? Because Saul was technically one of the sons. David was one of the sons of Saul because he had married in, right? So in a sense, he's claiming rights even within the house of Saul. But as y'all know, he probably should have just left Michal right there where she was. see what happens in a minute. Verse 17, it says, then Abner conferred with the elders of Israel, saying, for some time past you have been seeking David as king over you. Now then, bring this about, for the Lord has promised David, saying, by the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies. Verse 18 is a very important verse going forward specifically. But notice, Abner knows what the Lord has promised to do through David, and yet he still stands opposed to him, right? There is no end to how foolish a man will get when he is shamed, right? If you offend a man, right, and his honor, right, and his... Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I was just about to say,
kind of human nature.
We get both things right here in this one story, right? Michal is going to unleash holy hell on David, right? And here's Abner is doing the same thing, and it's all over these issues of being discredited, being dishonored, being, you know, not respected as they ought to be. It's just, it's so fat. Now y'all remember these stories are 3,000 years old, right? Nothing has changed in human nature, right? Nothing has changed in human nature. I think it was Shelby Foote, the great Civil War historian, lived here in Memphis. At one point he said, the only thing that has ever changed in human history is the invention of air conditioning. Everything else remains the same. I think there's some insight on that. So here, Abner comes to the side of David. He is going to now plead David's case. He calls the elders of Israel to come in and side with David, right? So Abner, very influential. These are notes, top page 48 there. Mentioning the elders of Israel, he confers with those tribal leaders, and they are coming together, and apparently they're going to listen to him and accept, recognize David as king, but not yet, right? Verse 20, chapter 3, verse 20, Abner came with 20 men to David at Hebron, and David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. And Abner said to David, I will arise and go and will gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you. I'm going to talk about that make a covenant probably next week. There's a couple of things there that we haven't talked about. Remember, Jonathan made a covenant with David, and now Abner's making a covenant with David. God is going to make a covenant with David a little bit later. So I'll wait and talk about that next week. But he says, now I'm going to make this with you that you may reign over all that your heart desires. And so Abner sent David, David sent Abner away and he went in peace. After he does this, verse 22, Joab and his servants arrive and they hear that David has made this covenant with Abner and he loses his mind. He thinks Abner is trying to trick David. So verse 25. It says, Joab, David's general, says to him, you know that Abner, the son of Ner, came to deceive you and to know you're going out and you're coming in and to know all that you're doing. So Joab is like, why did you make a covenant with him? He's just trying to trick you so he can figure out what's going on so they can defeat you in battle. So Joab goes out in verse 26. He comes out of David's presence. He sends messengers after Abner, and Abner comes back. David doesn't know what Joab is doing, but Joab lures Abner back, and he kills him in Hebron, which is a city of refuge, right? Talk about that in just a second. And he does it, he says at the end of verse 27, to avenge the blood of his brother Asahel. And then when David hears about it in 28, David takes an oath. I and my kingdom are forever guiltless before the Lord for the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. May it fall upon the head of Joab and upon all his father's house. And may the house of Joab never be without one who has a discharge or who is leprous or who holds a spindle or who falls by the sword or who lacks bread. Boy, that's rough. So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner because he had put to death their brother Asahel in the battle of Gibeon. So here, Joab comes in and acts rashly, kills Abner, which again puts David's kingdom at risk, right? Because now they're going to think, well, David told Joab to go kill Abner, and that's not at all what happens. And so there in your notes on page 48, again, Joab kills Abner in Hebron, which is a city of refuge, which that was expressly forbidden to do, to murder, so to kill somebody out of vengeance. The only way that someone could be put to death is if it could be proven that they had murdered somebody through malice and premeditation, which, of course, that couldn't be proven of Abner because he was running away from Asahel when he killed him. So Joab transgresses Torah. He kills Abner, and David curses his family. And the curses that he mentions are all taken from the Torah, from the law, curses that are imposed on people for violating other parts of the law and commandments. So David's not doing anything just out of hand. He's actually basing what he says there on what the Lord himself had already done or had already commanded concerning such things. Now let's finish up this chapter and we'll break right there. It'll be a good place to break. 31, David said to Joab and to all the people who were with him, tear your clothes, put on sackcloth and mourn before Abner. Right? Most of the kings of the nations would have rejoiced over Abner's death. This is his number one adversary, right? Until he came over to his side. But David has this period of mourning for him. They buried Abner at Hebron, verse 33. And look at verse 32. Don't miss this. This is really important. And the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner and all the people with him. This is the first time that David is referred to as the king. It's been hinted at earlier. He's been called, you'll be called to be a prince over the people of Israel. You'll be a shepherd for the people of Israel. You'll be a ruler. But here he's specifically referred to as the king. David weeps over Abner. He laments over Abner, verse 33. Should Abner die as a fool dies? Your hands were not bound. Your feet were not fettered. As one who falls before the wicked, you have fallen. That's probably just part of a longer lament that David gave and basically saying Abner was killed like a fool and he didn't deserve that. David fast over Abner for the rest of the day. The people try to get him to say, hey, come in, have some bread. But yet he won't. And finally, he relents and comes in. And this is very important. Verse 36, the way David mourns over Abner. And all the people took notice of it, and it pleased them as everything that the king, there it is again, the king did pleased all the people. And so all the people and all Israel understood that day that it had not been the king's will to put to death Abner, the son of Ner. And the king said to his servants, do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? Same way he mourned over Saul and Jonathan. You know, and I said there, for the most part in these texts, we've only heard about the negative things, the bad things that Saul did, right? But at the same time, it's hinted at there's a lot of really good things that Saul did too. But that's not the point of this narrative, right? The point of this narrative is to emphasize why the kingdom was stripped away from Saul and given to David, right? But these were great, mighty men, Abner, Saul, Jonathan, in their own way. Did they make foolish mistakes? Absolutely, right? But here's the whole point. Don't we all, right? There's only one person, there's only one human being in all of human history that has done everything right 100% of the time. His name is Jesus, right? There's only one of him. All the rest of us, as Paul summarizes in such a great way, for we have all sinned and fallen far short of the glory of God. Right, the glory that we were designed to exhibit, we fall so far short of that. And that's really important because y'all know by the end of this story, even David too is going to fall. Verse 39, now I was gentle today, though I was anointed king. These men, the sons of Zeruiah, are more severe than I. The Lord repay the evildoer according to this wickedness. So David says this thing. These nephews of mine, these are harsh men. That's not who I am. That's not the kind of king I'm going to be. Right? And we're going to see this going forward. Chapter 4, Ish-bosheth is murdered. And then finally, David is anointed king over Israel in chapter 5. And he brings the ark back to Jerusalem in chapter 6. So go ahead and read those chapters for next week, chapter 4, 5, and 6. We're going to make pretty quick work out of those. There's not a lot that's difficult to understand. And so we're just going to touch on the high points that move us forward. But these first three chapters are so important with what comes after it in 2 Samuel. I wanted to spend a little bit more time on those. So, yeah, go ahead and read those, and we will work through those for next week. Now, anybody, any questions or comments as we close out here? Everybody tracking along okay? Doing all right? All righty. Well, let me pray for us, and we will close out here. Father, again, we thank you just for the opportunity to get together today. And as we leave here, still some hazardous situations out on the road, I pray that you'll protect everybody driving about this afternoon, getting back home. Pray for all those who are still snowed in, iced in, can't get out of their driveways. We pray that this rain and the higher temperatures will make quick work of that so we can get back to normal this week. But we do thank you for your word and for all the ways that you guide and direct us to give us insight into you and your ways and the way you're moving all of history toward your good and glorious conclusions. And Lord, we really need that in the midst of these messed up times in which we're living, where people struggle to even know what the truth is and what's up and what's down, what's right, what's wrong. As Paul says, we live in a dark and twisted generation. And so help us through the knowledge of you and your word to shine as lights in the midst of that generation. And so we give you all thanks for all these things and all praise for Jesus' great name's sake. Amen.